Today I'm talking to Richard C. Cook. Richard C. Cook has a lengthy and impressive biography, including time spent in the U.S. Civil Service Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, the Carter White House, NASA, and the U.S. Treasury Department. He has written the widely acclaimed book Challenger Revealed about the cover-up behind the Challenger investigation, and writes articles on a range of topics, including monetary reform, which can be found at richardccook.com. Mr. Cook, thank you for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
All right. Now, Richard C. Cook, you certainly have a wide-ranging field of expertise and experience, but today I'd like to draw on your economic expertise in particular to go over two articles that you wrote last year, Monetary Reform and How a National Monetary System Should Work, and An Emergency Program of Monetary Reform for the United States. Now, of course, I want to get into the positive solutions that you can offer for the very serious economic hardships that we're facing. But first, I'd like to take a cue from your articles, which start by defining the root of our economic unrest. So can you start by telling us the nature of the monetary system we're living in and why we need this economic reform?
Well, we have an advanced industrial economy in the United States that has developed over a long period of time, and we have, in order to make the goods and services that are produced within that economy, a monetary system that is a kind of means of access to distribution of what is produced, but it's on the distribution side that our economy really has not succeeded. We are able to produce goods and services pretty much to the extent that we wish to. People often don't really appreciate the power of an industrial economy and how easy it is with industrial methods to produce goods and services, and particularly in an advanced economy, way beyond the extent of what can really even be consumed. For instance, there's a tremendous glut in the world today of automobiles because there's so many people who can produce automobiles. There's not an ability of the economies of the world even to keep up with it, particularly in the advanced nations. But the problem is with distribution. The problem is getting the goods and services into the hands of people who need it for their livelihood in order to live, for their families to live, to have a decent standard of living, because the way goods and services are distributed is through the monetary system. And we have a monetary system that has developed over time, which is entirely based upon debt. This is what the Federal Reserve System is. It's introducing purchasing power into the economy only by lending from financial institutions. And every loan that is made by a financial institution has to be repaid into the bank, but it also has to be repaid with interest. And the amount of money created is never sufficient to pay the interest on the debt. And so the interest increases exponentially over time to the point where you get a tremendous, what is called a debt overhang on the economy. That's what we have today. We have a very slow growth economy, about 2% per annum of growth with the GDP. But the monetary system, in order to consume that, produces so much debt that the debt now is at a level far beyond what the annual GDP is. It's something like 4 to 5 times what the gross domestic product is. And its ability of the economy to allow for consumption without tremendous amounts of debt, that's really the root cause of the financial system collapse that we have today. It goes very deeply into the structure of the monetary system, and this is what most people really do not understand.
Now, I think that the system being fundamentally based on debt brings up the specter of finance capitalism, which you mentioned in your articles. And you talk of finance capitalism versus democratic capitalism. Can you flesh out that distinction and its significance?
Well, capitalism as a method of accumulating resources through savings in order to invest it in the industrial economy goes back well into the 19th century when the Industrial Revolution came along, and even has its roots in earlier periods. But basically, it's a method for people to pool their savings, pool their resources, in order to mechanize production processes and create an industrial economy. And there's really nothing wrong with that. There's no inherent flaw in doing that. People have the right and should have the right to pool resources in order to accomplish economic goals. The problem is when the investment side of the economy is not fueled by pooling of resources, but it's filled by bank debt, bank lending, particularly bank lending through the fractional reserve system, where the bank only holds a very small amount of capital in its reserve and then is more or less licensed or chartered by the government to produce what John Maynard Keynes called money out of thin air. That's the kind of bank credits that are put into place through the Federal Reserve System and the modern banking system, where they don't really have the capital behind it. It's just credit that is authorized by charter for them to essentially control and invest however they see it. But again, this money created out of thin air also has the price tag of interest attached to it. Now, the reason that finance capitalism exists on the scale it does today has to do with a basic structural problem with an industrial economy that John Maynard Keynes identified back in the 1930s that was really the underlying structural cause of the Great Depression. And this is that as the economy produces goods and services and charges prices for those to be consumed and distributed, profits from that enterprise always must include a certain amount of savings or a certain amount of retained capital that are set aside to continue to innovate in the production cycle and to reinvest into the production process so that the corporation or the business entity can keep producing at the same level of efficiency that it had before. Keynes understood that withholding this retained earnings as savings would prevent money being paid out in income to people who need purchasing power in order to produce what the economy, in order to consume what the economy is producing. This is a gap. It's a gap between income and purchasing power that Keynes had identified as being the cause of the Great Depression, because it's the old poverty in the midst of plenty syndrome. It's where the economy is producing at a high level, but the people in the society, the consumers, don't have enough income from wages, salaries, and dividends to buy what the economy can produce. And so then the economy slides into a recession, which becomes a depression, where you have that phenomenon of farmers pouring milk in the fields because the consumers in the cities who needed the milk didn't have enough money to buy it. So the question then becomes, how do you monetize the gap between what the people earn through income and what the pricing system requires to achieve the full consumption that the economy is producing? Now, that gap is what Keynes said should be filled by borrowing by the government. It's the pump priming method that is the basis of Keynesian economics. But what has happened in our country is that the gap has become so extreme because we've lost so many of our manufacturing jobs due to outsourcing that the only way the gap can be filled is through bank lending. And this is where finance capitalism comes in, because finance capitalism is not primarily used today any longer for investment in productive processes. It's used to finance consumption. People have to borrow money in order to obviously buy a house because they have a mortgage payment, to buy a car, and even increasingly to use the credit card to buy even things that are necessities of life, like food, clothing, and things like that. So there's this tremendous gap or shortfall of purchasing power in our economy. The reason that we are having so many problems today and are sliding further into a recession is that people can no longer sustain the high level of borrowing that they need for consumption. And so consumers are cutting back on their charging on their credit cards. The housing bubble collapse no longer allows them to use mortgages and home equity loans as ways to cash in on their equity and acquire purchasing power. So we have a wholesale collapse of purchasing power in the economy, and it's starting to show up in increased unemployment. It's showing up in a decline in the amount of money that's available for immediate consumption, which is what the Federal Reserve calls M1. And it's this tremendous collapse of purchasing power in the United States that is driving us into the recession that has already begun.
Well, if that then is finance capitalism, what is democratic capitalism?
Well, democratic capitalism has a couple different aspects to it. One would be, first of all, that the capital markets are allowed to function freely, with people putting their savings into the capital markets, as we imagine they are, you know, through their 401ks or through formerly purchase of savings bonds, things like that, where all of the people who are working within the economy do have a level of savings that they can put into the capital markets and gain some income from their savings. But as we know, the savings rate has declined to a negative savings rate, where people are now spending even their 401ks and are no longer even saving the money that they had put into the capital markets formerly. Now, the other aspect of democratic capitalism would be through a national dividend. And this is where the whole social credit idea comes in, because under social credit, which is the system that was developed in Great Britain in the 1920s and 30s by C.H. Douglas and the people who were part of the social credit movement, would actually provide people with a dividend which represents a monetization of the appreciation of the producing economy that is pulled out of the system at the point of sale by savings and retained earnings. And you actually capitalize that appreciation by giving people a dividend each year or periodically, which represents the growth of the economy that the individual consumer within the economy has a right to gain some resource from. And if we did this, one way to look at it is look at the Alaska Permanent Fund, where every year every resident of Alaska gets a certain amount of money, which is a dividend on resource revenues in the state. And this year, the Alaska Permanent Fund is going up to $2,000 per resident. Last year, it was $1,700 per resident. And this is a cash payment that goes to every single resident of Alaska. There's no means test. It doesn't matter if they're employed or unemployed. It doesn't matter what the level of income is. It's a dividend that is their fair share of the economy of the state based upon the resources that the state produces or that the state leases it out to private companies. That money then becomes available for people within the economy to spend or invest any way they want to. They can use it to pay down debt, they can use it for education expenses, or they can use it to capitalize small businesses. Small business in this country has collapsed. Small business cannot compete with the chain stores, with the franchises. Small businesses cannot borrow money at a low rate of interest. And so we have a tremendous failure rate of small business. To capitalize small business, and another feature that the dividend would do, to capitalize family farming or localized farming, which we're also losing in this country, would be a form of democratic capitalism. Democratic capitalism means that you put money directly in the hands of people for them to invest however they wish to do it, whether it be in the capital markets, in small business, in family farming, or for them to invest in their own education, their children's education, things like that. That is what we do not have any longer in this country. We do not have an investment or a savings base in the hands of the people of the country that they can use for their own purposes.
So if I have this correct, what the social credit theory is proposing is to take that gap that you mentioned earlier between the gross domestic product of a nation and its purchasing power, and to fill that gap by printing money into existence in the same way that banks create money out of nothing in the current system.
Well, it's similar in a way, because in the things that I've written, I talk about credit and attempt to define credit as not the private property of a bank that has been chartered to create it out of nothing as their own personal property, which is the way it's treated today. But I treat credit as the productive potential of the nation. The credit is the ability of the nation to produce goods and services in the future. And so it's a power of nature. I liken it to a public utility like electricity, like clean water, like clean air. It's really the property of the entire population of a country in terms of what their potential is for producing. Then, instead of allocating that capital potential or that producing potential to private banks, which is really the first and foremost system of privatization of public resources that we had in this country when we gave the banks the authority over credit, which we did with the Federal Reserve System in 1913, rather than allocating that credit to the private banking industry, we give it to the government, which is created on the basis of the general welfare, a government of we the people, and we then utilize that credit in a public-spirited way, at, by the way, a much lower interest charge or no interest at all if we distribute it through the national dividend. But it really draws on the same abstract power of future production that we have allocated to the bank. So it's taking that power, that public utility, and utilizing it for the people rather than for the banks.
All right. So broadly speaking, what are the steps that needed to take this monetary reform to the next level and bring this system about?
Well, the first thing that we have to deal with is the fact that our nation, under our debt-based monetary system, is functionally bankrupt. We have right now a debt overhang on the producing economy, and if you count in there household debt, student debt, individual debt, business debt, and government debt, somewhere in the neighborhood of $70 trillion. And so the first thing that we have to do is to restructure that debt and begin paying it down and pay off the people that we owe money to. And then, having done that, we need to restructure our financial system so that the government is generating credit out of the natural productive potential of the nation rather than allowing the banks to do it anymore. So there's a whole series of reform measures that would allow to do this, us to do this. Let me just refer to the model legislation that has been created by an organization called the American Monetary Institute. We have what we call the American Monetary Act, which I contributed to and which can be found on the AMI website, that would begin by bringing the Federal Reserve System back under the authority of the executive branch of government and begin to restructure the existing debt so that that debt can be paid down and essentially retired and in some cases even canceled, because we have a tremendous amount of debt that simply ought to be canceled through a bankruptcy proceeding. I would put a lot of student debt into that category, where we are unfairly charging students an extraordinary amount of money on interest payments to finance their college education. So a lot of that debt should be retired. Then the government needs to begin to create a new monetary system that is not introduced into circulation through bank debt, but by direct issuances of currency by the federal government. There are really three ways of doing this that that I've written about. One I've already talked about, and that is the national dividend, a annual cash payment as an individual share in the appreciation of the producing economy that's paid out to individuals as a dividend. A second way is by infrastructure financing by the federal government. The federal government in the past, if you look back at the Great Depression during the New Deal, had an organization called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And it was really an infrastructure bank that lent money at very low rates of interest for the physical economy of the U.S. It lent to state and local governments. School buildings were built with it. Hospitals were built with it. It went into farming. It went into certain types of industry. It was a low-cost way of allocating credit to the physical economy through a federal infrastructure bank. Now, such a bank has been introduced in Congress. The best legislation that I've seen on this has been introduced by Dennis Kucinich. It would be capitalized out of the cash that the federal government has on balance with the Federal Reserve System, and it would provide zero interest loans to state and local governments for infrastructure projects. On a sufficient scale, that would create a new currency for the United States. It would be a currency that comes into existence being backed by the physical economy of the United States and the physical infrastructure of the United States rather than bank loans. So that would be a second way to do it. The third way to do it would be through a monetary innovation that would be similar to the greenbacks during the Civil War period. The greenbacks were funds, paper money that were backed by gold, spent directly into circulation by the government to pay its expenses during the Civil War. It was used to pay approximately 10% of the federal budget. Contrary to what a lot of people say who are kind of in favor of bank financing, it was not inflationary. And what most people don't understand is that greenbacks were part of the U.S. currency all the way up into the early part of the 20th century. In fact, legislation authorizing direct spending of government funds by the greenback method still exists. It's still on the books of the U.S. government, although all the greenbacks have been retired and don't exist any longer. But that would be the third method of funding. It would be direct spending by the government for expenditures that the government incurs in doing its usual business, and that would be another way of introducing a different type of money into circulation. So these are three methods that would create a new monetary system for the United States. Now, we would still have some kind of a banking system because banks are useful and necessary for liquidity and commerce by using what we call the real bills doctrine, where the banks are used for financing everyday business and transactions of the business firms. But we don't need a banking system that rests on enormous speculative investments. We don't need a banking system that primarily is used to finance consumption, or that is used simply to inflate assets, like we saw with the housing bubble, with the equity bubble, previously with the dot-com bubble, those sort of things. Those are misuses of credit, misuses of the banking system. But if we were able to use these methods of government-introduced money that I've cited, we would have a new monetary system for the United States, not based upon debt, but based upon the real productive values of the nation.
Now, the Austrian School of Economics argues that replacing one form of fiat money with another form, whether it be under the hands of the bankers or the hands of a government, is inevitably going to lead to an inflationary death spiral of that monetary instrument. And they would argue vigorously for a return to the gold standard or gold-backed or asset-backed, at least, monetary instruments. What do you say to that idea that printing money out of nothing is inevitably going to lead to an inflationary spiral?
The Austrian School of Economics really is the same financial system that we had in the United States before the Civil War with the state system of state-chartered banks. Now, this was supposedly on the gold standard, these banks, because at that time you could take a paper currency that a bank issued into a bank and asked for gold in return. In fact, the banks used to kind of gang up on each other at that time. They would collect a lot of the banknotes from a bank and take those into the bank, demand gold, and when the bank obviously couldn't pay because there was never enough gold around to capitalize the entire monetary system, the bank would fold. The gold standard is a system that has always been the one favored by the big banking syndicates. We went into a gold standard in the latter part of the 19th century when silver was demonetized. Silver was demonetized through a congressional legislation in 1873. It was called the Crime of 73 because everybody knew what was going to happen was that the monetary system would deflate so much that the people who needed to borrow money in order to survive, like farmers, business people, small business, could not possibly keep up with payments on their loans because their receipts from what they were able to produce were deflating because of the collapse of the monetary system. And that's exactly what happened. That's why we had the depression of the 1890s that William Jennings Bryan reacted to so strongly when he made that famous speech at the Democratic Convention in 1900, "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." And I would say to the Austrian banks, which really have a system more suited to 1830 than to a modern industrial system that has tremendous need for capital and for purchasing power, I would say the same thing. To the Austrians, "You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." You have to have a system that is geared to the real productive values of the economy. And as long as you can maintain and regulate the monetary system according to what the economy really is capable of producing, and in order to do that, you need a tremendous amount of purchasing power because people need, in an industrial economy, the ability to buy a home, to buy a car, to buy the necessities of life, to educate their children. If you had a monetary system that could do that, you would not need a gold standard. Now, it does not mean that gold cannot serve a useful purpose as a hedge against inflation. It was used up until the 1970s to settle international debts, and it was the removal of that gold window that gave us the modern period of inflation that we have. But even back when we had the gold standard, as we had, for instance, in World War I, it did not prevent a tremendous inflation from taking place after World War I simply because the banks revalued the currency, and they did it primarily to drive the old greenbacks and coinage out of circulation. So a gold standard does not protect you from inflation. The gold standard, all it does is restrict the currency and prevent it from being flexible enough to accommodate the kind of purchasing power that you need in a modern industrial economy. So that's why the real key to keeping an economy under control, a monetary system under control, is to gear the monetary supply to production, not to an artificial gold standard.
All right. Well, my final question today is one of feasibility. What do you see as the political will? Do you see the political will out there to institute the monetary reforms which you're proposing?
The reforms that we're talking about, say even 5 years ago, were almost unknown. Now, since that time, we've had the collapse of the housing bubble. We've had the campaign for president that Ron Paul ran, where we, for the first time, have a presidential candidate calling for a reevaluation of the Federal Reserve System. And just within the last couple of days in Washington, we had a press conference where Ron Paul and Ralph Nader, Cynthia McKinney, and other leaders of third-party movements came out for a complete reassessment of the Federal Reserve System. So the knowledge of this is spreading. And I think as we continue to see the collapse of our financial system, and now we have the takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac by the Treasury Department, because that system is bankrupt, the more we go into the recession that we're in, we're losing, we lost 60,000 jobs last month. The currency is not sufficient to keep up with the cost of living because of the growth of gas prices, the growth of food prices. The crisis is here. And as the crisis continues to develop, I think more and more people will be looking for alternative solutions. The burden really is on the monetary reformers and the more progressive political people to educate the population on the necessity of doing this. But it will not take necessarily a mass movement to get something like this done, because if enough people, I think, who understand the situation, have the ability to articulate it, are ready to step in when the crisis comes, that's the opportunity, I think, that may exist. I'm not saying it will exist, but it may exist.
All right, some very insightful analysis. Richard C. Cook, how can people find out more about your work?
Well, I have a website. It's www.richardccook.com. People can access that and reach me and what I've been working on through that. Most of my articles are on the Global Research website, so they can just go into a search engine and enter Global Research. I also have an email address that people can write to get on my mailing list. Let me tell you what that is. It's economicsanity@gmail.com. People can write to me through that email. We'll get them on the mailing list. And also, it will have information about my new book that's coming out. It's called We Hold These Truths, The Hope of Monetary Reform. And that should be out within the next couple of months.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that book. And Richard C. Cook, it was a delight talking to you today, and I certainly hope I can talk to you again in the future. Thank you for joining me today on the Corbett Report.
Great. Thank you very much.